Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of arts and culture. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulippe, and today I'll be speaking with Seth Eisen and Marga Gomez about the Out of Sight Queer History Walking Tour. Actors Rona Figueroa and David Breitbart are here to tell us about ACT's new production of Ionesco's Rhinoceros. And singer, actor, and impressionist Christine Bianco is also in the studio. She's performing tonight at Nico's. And critic at large Peter Robinson talks with travel writer Joel Strat McClure about his trilogy of travel narratives, The Idiot and The Odyssey. All here during the next hour on Open Air. My first guests are Rona Figueroa and David Breitbart. Thanks so much for coming in to KALW today.
Thanks for having us.
Open Air. Great to see you. You are in this new production of Ionesco's Rhinoceros.
Yes, we are.
Which is called an absurdist satire, but also a comedy. Do you think of it as a comedy? It's funny?
For sure.
It is hilarious a lot of the time. At other times, it is downright brutally scary. And I think it's by design, too, that it is so funny, because I think that Ionesco knew that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And I think it's easier for audiences to digest what's really being said if they have a good belly laugh before they get served it.
This is 1959, right?
That's when it was written, yeah.
And Ionesco wrote it. He was in Romania. A group of friends, sort of radical thinkers, met every once in a while to discuss politics and intellectual thought and current events. And then it sounds like one by one, they each said, well, the Nazis aren't so bad, maybe, and
they found
maybe they're right about the Jews, and that he said they left until there were only three or four out of the original group of 15 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah. They found, each of them found one little chink in the armor, an intellectual in, to be able to convert to
their nationalists.
Yes.
Posse, whatever. There were, I guess, different variations on the Nazi theme, right? Because there's a different name, I think, for the one in Romania.
The Black Guard.
Yeah. So what could this possibly, what relevance could it possibly have for our current day? And why
I don't know.
Why launch this play now at ACT?
Because rhinos are cool.
Rhinos are cool. Yeah, and there are only a few of them left. This is running through June 23rd at ACT's Geary Theater, and the website is act-sf.org. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the roles that you each play in Rhinoceros.
I play the role of Daisy. She's Behringer's love interest from far away. They work together in an office. There's a group of people working in the office. And she has, I guess, affection for another man, a young up-and-coming lawyer. In the second act, she comes to check in on Behringer. He's not feeling that great. And then the story kind of goes into a whirlwind, and things happen.
Mm. And David, you play Behringer?
I play Behringer, yeah. And you know, Behringer's not, as a character, exists in more than one play than Rhinoceros. I think Ionesco wrote maybe three or four different Behringers into other plays. Mm-hmm. And he symbolizes an everyman, an ordinary man who often gets caught up in extraordinary circumstances, and that's certainly the case with Rhinoceros.
And he's the only one left at the end? Is that true?
This is true.
You know, I was thinking about these films, which are sort of a parallel of everybody gets taken over, like Stepford Wives, Night of the Living Dead, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, all sort of made around something in the air in the 60s and 70s that right after this play was written. But in each of those films, there's sort of only one person
individual
left at the end. Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, in the mob mentality.
And Berenger has some line about, you know, when individuals hold on to their...
Well, yeah, like the penultimate line in the play, yeah.
What is that?
People who try to hang on to their individuality always come to a bad end.
But he does that himself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yes.
So what is different about this particular production? Tell me about the director, Frank Galati, mm-hmm. and what he had in mind in particular.
Well, Frank's not here to tell you what he had in mind, but this is the seventh show that I've done with him. He's a remarkable man and a remarkable director. He's an original Steppenwolf company member, the theater company in Chicago, and he adapted and directed the original Grapes of Wrath that played on Broadway, and he directed the original Ragtime that played on Broadway, and he's been nominated for an Academy Award. He's an astonishingly
Renaissance kind of guy.
Yeah, there's nothing he can't do well. He's gentle, he's brilliant, he's creative, he's just who you want to be in the room with.
Yeah, yeah.
And we are among the lucky ones who have gotten to do it.
Yeah, that's been a very unique aspect of this experience for me, working with such a positive, warm, and still very sensitive and keen kind of director.
And how are the rhinoceroses actually portrayed? I think it's done in different ways, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't, because there's physical transformation, and sometimes the character right in front of your your character transforms into a rhinoceros.
Yeah, my best friend in the play
does
it. That's the only time
Zero Mostel did in the film.
That's correct.
Film, right?
That's correct. It's quite different than what Zero did, and it's probably just as, if not more, effective. I think the way Matt does it with us. You're right. It's several different ways. Primarily, the most contact that we and the audience have with rhinoceroses is with sound. We have incredible sound design in this show, and it's ever present. It's another character in the play. And it thunders throughout the theater.
But there's also a 3D model, and then there's a 2D model, and then there are people in costume.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. So the rhinoceros is a metaphor, but it's also real. I mean, it's kind of the idea that you can take a completely absurd notion and it can take hold and gradually become reality is so amazing, and it's so incredibly timely.
Yeah. I mean, our director talked about the post-truth and how that is happening now. The conversations of our government administration and the kinds of ideas that are trying to be twisted and spun around, and how it's trying to be passed as truth.
Yeah.
And some people are buying into it. And
yeah, the entire Republican Party. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys are giving it away.
it's amazing. So this is playing through June 23rd. It's Tuesdays through Saturdays, 8 o'clock, Wednesdays and Saturdays at 2, and Sundays at 2 o'clock. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. And Saturday night at... Oh, yeah, that... Right, unless it's this Sunday night, there's a 7 p.m. Sunday night as well.
ACT's Geary Theater, 415 Geary Street here in San Francisco. And, yeah, tell me more about sort of your character's interaction. And
well, Berenger has been admiring and loving Daisy from afar for many years, I think. And he's he's you know, a few years older than she is, and he knows that she has her eyes on another guy in the office who's considerably younger and more well-adjusted in the world. He's not a drunken slob,
like
the
Berringer.
Like Berringer is. But it's all for existential reasons. I think Berringer's just has been having an existential crisis for probably a couple of decades.
Rona, what is your own background as an actor?
My background as an actor. I actually started out as a singer, and I wasn't thinking about acting at all. And I kind of, through the singing aspect of my passion, I fell into the acting. So, like, because of my singing, my love for singing, I got into musicals. And then in musicals, you know, there's a story that we have to tell. And through that, and wanting to sing more songs, well, the lead girl gets to sing most of the songs, right? So I have to, like, learn what she's doing. That's basically how I got into the acting world. I didn't go to school for it. I wanted to, but my parents wanted me to be a lawyer or a doctor. Mm. But I was just very lucky when I was offered the ensemble, an ensemble track in Miss Saigon, and from there sort of found my way into different roles and more musicals and doing the singing that I wanted to do, and discovering that I really love acting, and that actually my favorite part of the singing is the storytelling. So song or no song, I really just love story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's going on now. It's already opened, Rhinoceros.
We opened last night.
You opened last night. How did it go?
I'm told it went very well. I hear there's a really
flattering
newspaper review. I've only read the headline.
My mom woke up and said, nothing's been written yet. And I think it was like 8 a.m. or something.
Do you read reviews?
I'm curious. I don't usually read reviews, but I'm curious about this one.
I'll probably read them when the show's closed. I read them where I come from. I live in Florida and been working at a company there for 23 years, and where we first did Rhinoceros. And I read them there just because I know that they don't make a difference to me. I mean, I shouldn't say it.
Well, I want to read these reviews because I think that the story is complicated and I want to know how it's received. And I think that the character development, like my character goes through really sort of illogical seeming emotional and psychological changes. And so I just want to see how that was translated to the people watching it. Also, the piece is originally about 3 hours long and ours is about, 75 minutes?
Oh.
About 90. About 90 with intermission.
With intermission. Yeah. And I want to know how, you know, if that is confusing or if it was good. It was more.
The original is 3 hours long?
It's a lot longer,
yeah.
Yeah.
With characters
that were
cut from our version, yeah.
I see.
I would say more confusing. There are conversations that are happening simultaneously.
Yeah. Our production barrels along like a rhino stampede, pretty much. It's very effective.
Is it hard to tread the line between great 20th century classic and comedy? Is that a difficult balance?
I'm not sure of your question. What do you mean, a 20th century classic?
Classic, I mean, well, the fact that it's funny, but it's also deadly serious.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I don't think one could exist without the other. I mean, the comedy is not. There aren't a lot of punchlines in this show. It's born out of situation and character.
I think that Frank, our director, also mentioned that actually absolute naturalism would deliver the comedy best for this absurdist situation.
Makes sense.
Yeah, but I don't know if we're doing theater, not TV, so it's a little removed from natural.
Speak for yourself.
Whispered conversation.
Yes. ACT's Geary Theater, 415 Geary Street, here in San Francisco. Rhinoceros plays until June 23rd. And the website is act-sf.org for more information. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
It's great to talk with you.
You too.
Sounds like a really fantastic production.
It's
and
pretty
congratulations.
Fun.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Open Air, the weekly radio magazine of arts and culture here on KALW. We'll be back in just a moment with Christina Bianco. Listening to Open Air. I am Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulippe, and special thanks to producer Neil Swinkles and board operator Jean Marie. My next guest is singer, actor, and impressionist Christina Bianco. You're returning to Feinstein's at the Nico with your new show, Me, Myself, and Everyone Else. It's tonight, so thank you so much for coming in on the day of a big performance.
Thank you. It's fine. No, it's been a whirlwind trip. I'm from New York, and I haven't performed in the West Coast in too long. It's been a few years now, so I crammed in as many performances as I could. Last night, I was in San Diego.
Ah.
Tonight, San Francisco. Then back to L.A., and then Vegas, and then home. So it's I can't spend as much time enjoying each city as I'd like, but I'd rather be here than not. So
that's incredible. Do you fly everywhere?
Yeah, this trip I am, but I'm quite used to it. I've been a bit of a globetrotter recently. Very lucky, doing what I love. But yeah, a short flight is hardly like anything to me anymore after going to and from Australia a few times this year, so it's fine.
So you travel the world, and you've had an amazing career as an actress in theater and television, and you've gotten a lot of attention for your celebrity impressions. I think 7 million views for one of your YouTube videos.
Yeah, it's a crazy total, like 25 million or something. And I think kids today rack up a lot more than that. But a few years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, it was amazing. I never thought, as sort of a working actor and singer, always singing in bands and more glamorous work with symphonies and all that, I never thought that with the click of a button, one night of me singing a song, impromptu in a nightclub, that the next morning I'd wake up with all these followers, all these views, and then it would open so many doors for me. You just, nothing prepares you for that, is the greatest and coolest surprise of my life.
How did you start doing impressions?
Well, the story goes that my parents say that I was always singing along to whatever was playing, and they would hear me, just completely inadvertently take on the tone and the style of that particular artist. I wouldn't do it all the time, but she would say, watching those movies like Judy Garland and The Wizard of Oz, Julie Andrews and Mary Poppins, and as I was getting older, listening to, Madonna and stuff, I would be a little more nasal singing along to Madonna and be a little more soft with round tones for Julie Andrews. And I remember my mom saying to me when she knew I wanted to sing and was putting me in classes and taking me to school shows and all that, I remember her saying, "Don't sing it like the recording, sing it like you." And I thought she just meant, how to interpret the song and the phrasing. But looking back, I just had this natural ear for mimicry. Luckily, I've, you know, I always had my own voice and always found it, but it's always been easy for me to slip in and out of voices. And I just didn't take it seriously until I was cast in a show in New York that I had gone to see as a little kid. It's a show called Forbidden Broadway. Some people may know. It spoofs and parodies all the Broadway shows and their stars, much like Saturday Night Live does for pop culture. And it's two men and two women in the show, and they play every role on Broadway. So I always thought they were the most talented people. That must be the most fun job. You get to do all the shows in one night. And these great actors did impressions. So I saw an audition for it, and I thought, well, you know, I don't think it's embarrassing if I went to this. I've been listening to it for years. I know how it works, and I'm always told I take direction. Well, I can sing many styles. I'll just go see what happens. Oh, my gosh. I was blown away. Cast in the show, lucky enough to get great reviews and, you know, in the New York Times, and then I was nominated for a Drama Desk Award for my performance. And after that, everybody just wanted me to come do impressions places. And at first, I was a little bit taken aback. I was like, oh, I'll never, you know, like, sing as me again. But luckily, that's not happened. I think because I've always worked as myself and had a career first, you know, as me, I'm always able to be both myself. Me, Myself, and Everyone Else is the title of the show, to be a little cheesy. But the show is half my voice and half impression. And it's basically a musical comedy celebration of all of the great divas and all the great celebrities we love and the music. So it's not just, you know, if I can't impersonate somebody, I still try to touch on their legacy or their song and discuss it or their great film work or whatnot.
And this is tonight at Nico's?
Yeah, at Feinstein's at the Nico.
Feinstein at the Nico. And the website is feinsteinssf.com.
Mm-hmm.
And your website is christinabianco.com.
Yes, indeed.
We're going to do an impression speed round.
Oh, yes. Okay. This can be fun or tragic, but I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good about this.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to try to, this whole speed round thing is what a lot of impressionists do to sort of stay on top of impressions. You say, how quickly can you sort of, you know, key into one? What can you do? So I try to do this in about 5 words or less. So whoever you throw at me, I'm going to try to, you know, take on their voice, and you can't see it at home, but their mannerisms in 5 words or less.
Okay, here we go.
Okay.
Miley Cyrus.
Oh my God, that's pretty cool. I should have it to be here.
Kim Kardashian.
Oh, I love my selfie.
Gwen Stefani.
This stuff is bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S.
Penelope Cruz.
Oh, Vanilla Sky.
I don't know why I said that. Drew Barrymore.
Oh, this is amazing.
Barbara Walters.
Good evening and welcome to 2020.
Kristen Wiig.
Hey, hi, I am Kristen Wiig, and I'm wacky.
Celine Dion. Oh.
Near, far, wherever you are.
Keira Knightley.
What? Is this a radio show? I thought it was television. Am I right?
Dora the Explorer.
Hola, soy Dora!
I had to back away from the mic for that one.
Britney Spears.
Oh. The jet lag and the groggy voice helps with that one a little bit.
Did you just get off the plane?
I did. I got off a plane, and it's my luggage is in your lobby, so thank you. I'll be moving in. I'll be good. Staying here.
Glad to hear it. You played Dora the Explorer in the
very
musical?
First. Yeah, there's a big national tour, and the first launch of the tour is always the biggest and most grand. So yes, I was out of college, and I booked right away this national tour with Clear Channel, Viacom, and Nickelodeon, and it was great. They wanted somebody who could, of course, sound like Dora, but without, you can't do that for an entire show because that sort of yelling that she does can get very grating. Everyone in the room is rolling their eyes. They know, yeah. But the kids respond to it. So the fact that I could talk like a kid and be a little bit accessible, but then say, do you want to do this? You know, in that Dora voice. I think that helped get me the job. It was, I guess, one of the first impressions I ever did without realizing it. I think my height helps, too. Very often as a performer, particularly in theater and stage where it's all about visual pictures, my height is a great hindrance to me. I'm 4'11". There have been some greats, 4'11", Judy Garland, Kristen Chenoweth, Glenda in Wicked, 4'11". But alas, it's been more of a curse for me. But I think it helped me get that Dora the Explorer part.
Have you always liked being on stage? Have you always gravitated to the stage?
Yeah, I always did. It's funny, my mom tells the story again. My parents, they so wonderful for putting up with me, but also encouraging what I like to do. And I've lost the sort of chip that does this now. If I'm on stage in front of an audience, I'm happy to perform. But when I was little, I had that fearless attitude where if my mom said, go over there and sing, I'd be like, okay, and I'd climb on a chair and sing. I've lost that now. I'm a little more shy when it comes to that, even though it seems odd. I like to have the proper platform and do everything in the appropriate manner. But she said I just lit up every time I wanted to sing and perform. So they really fostered that and encouraged me. And I think I was in my very first play when I was 7 years old. You had to wait. You had to wait till you were seven and for the community theater production. You know, and that year it was Annie, and I was cast as Molly and Annie. And that was it, really. And then I was cast my very first... I tell a story in one of my shows, is that the first play that meant a lot to me was The Wizard of Oz. It was a production for kids, starring kids. You know, so I was too young to play Dorothy. I was, you know, 7 years old. But I wanted the part, so I insisted on singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow at the audition. I also had both of my two front teeth missing, though. So it just came out Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And, of course, I didn't get Dorothy. I was cast as a munchkin. But I think, as I say, standing out at the audition worked in my favor because the director decided that at the end of the show, as Dorothy was, you know, clicking her heels and going back to Kansas, that a little munchkin should come out and sing a reprise of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And so that I got to sing my favorite song in my very first show as a solo. So clearly... it created a monster. There's nowhere I could go from there. I could not be stopped. So, yeah, just such a ham of a performer ever since.
And you do impressions of Judy Garland and also her daughter, Liza Minnelli.
Yes, I do. I love the classics. I love Judy Garland, and I love that she's so popular again. I'm, you know, excited about the new movie coming out. And even just the resurgence of A Star is Born with Lady Gaga and Barbara Streisand. All these great women who I really love. I strongly believe that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So everything I do is done with love. And particularly the classic divas, there's such a whole their canon of work. I know it really well. Whereas mm-hmm. the contemporary divas, I can love them, but there's never as much to work with, you know. The legacy of those performers lives with me. From Edith Piaf to Marlene Dietrich, they're all in the show.
Have any of the living divas heard your impressions
yes.
and responded?
There have been a few. Luckily, I only know about the good ones, because if they're bad, they've kept it to... they didn't like it, they've kept it to themselves. But I mentioned Kristen Chenoweth, fantastic Broadway and Tony, an Emmy Award winner. We have some mutual friends. We've met a few times, and recently I was performing at a concert with her, and I made the decision with the executive team to not impersonate her, just in case it rubbed people the wrong way. You know, there's plenty of other people I can do. And afterwards, she came up to me, and she grabbed me by the arm, and she said, "You didn't do me. Why, next time you do me, you show them what we've got." So that was fun. Bernadette Peters, always a big inspiration to me. She, in a magazine article, said she thought my impression of her was fabulous. And Kathy Griffin tweeted that my impression was perfection. You know, so it's the list goes on. But it's always so good to know that they know it's done with love from the right place. I think if you poke too much fun and you stretch an impression where it becomes a caricature, I think it's not lasting. I certainly couldn't fill a whole show or a whole career doing that. It's not my cup of tea.
Me, Myself, and Everyone Else is tonight at 8 o'clock mm-hmm. at Feinstein's at the Nico. So you have, what, 6.5 hours until the show?
Definitely be quiet.
What's your process before then?
As I've been doing a lot of traveling, it's a very vocally demanding show. I have a pretty strong voice. I'm pretty tough, but, you know, unfortunately, with this sort of a show, I have to sing so many different styles. And not only am I changing the volume of my voice, but I'm really manipulating my vocal cords. Mm. Dolly Parton and Edith Piaf have very fast vibratos, the shake in their voice, whereas Edith Piaf is very, very strong, and I have to tighten everything and be very loud. Dolly Parton's very breathy and airy. Those two examples of how I have to be really flexible. So I'll be quiet for a while. I have some water and some throat coat tea. They should sponsor me. I just buy 90 billion boxes a year. But really, there's nothing like just getting out there and feeding off the crowd as well, because I like to have a very interactive show. You know, I don't just sing a Celine Dion song as Celine Dion or a Julie Andrews song as Julie Andrews. I will play with, you know, what would Julie Andrews sound like singing Donna Summer, you know, Hot Stuff, or... you know, what do I say, Celine Dion singing Aerosmith, something like that. I like playing with those things. And so to have that spontaneity, I like to interact with the audience as well. So keeps me on my toes and keeps me awake.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much, Christina Bianco.
Thank you for having me.
Have a wonderful time tonight.
Yeah.
You're listening to Open Air here on KALW San Francisco. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulippe. And in just a moment, I'll be talking with Marga Gomez and Seth Eisen about the Out of Sight Queer Walking Tour.
My friends keep telling me that you ain't no good.
An incredible song. My next guests are Seth Eisen and Marga Gomez. It's such a pleasure to see you. Thank you for coming in. You're here to talk about Out of Sight, that's S-I-T-E, performance-driven queer history walking tour. And this sounds really amazing because we're so inundated with these sort of touristy ideas of San Francisco and the wax museum and the cable car and this is getting to the real heart of the city. So tell me about how you started these walking tours and what it's about.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here with you. First of all, I've seen you perform, so it's just incredible.
Thank you so much.
Play a Lou Harrison piece at Pianos in the Park a few years ago.
Thank you, really
touched me.
Thank you, that means a lot to me.
Yeah, so this project started out with kind of a jolt of inspiration, seeing the LGBTQ historical context statement, which is a study that was done by the National Park Service during the Obama administration. And I read through it and I was like, wow, there's all these histories about San Francisco that people don't really know about and how queer people are part of the fabric of the culture. And I thought, I know what's going to happen with this. There's going to be a lot of plaques that go up, and they're going to be really amazing, like the new Rainbow Walk in the Castro. But I thought, I just had this spark of, like, what if those histories came to life on the street? And what if they happened in spaces where the histories actually happened? And what if the audiences were immersed in those histories? And that's really the vision of what this project is.
It sounds amazing. And I was looking up the Howard Langton Community Garden because that's where you're starting this tour, and that in the late 80s, the residents arranged to plant trees in memory of a neighbor who had died of AIDS. And that's the kind of history that many of us don't know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, the garden, well, a lot of magical things happen when you walk on the street and pay attention. You know, it's kind of a meditative practice in a way, you know, when you're just, Marga and I were just talking about that, of how, like, you just notice details, you know, moving through the city when you slow down and you're not rushing somewhere or looking at your phone. And our production manager and myself were sort of scouting locations, And I know that garden because I, when I was working in an adult day health center many years ago with people with HIV, we used to go there. And I just thought, oh, this would be nice just to peek in. And I recognized someone I knew there, and he said, oh, come in. And we went in, and I was like, this is the kind of magical thing that's so special about slowing down and being in the city and recognizing the spaces that are still left that are reminiscent of how the city was. And then we learned all these histories about that that garden that was, you know, it's right in the middle of South of Market. It's one of the few green spaces, and it used to be a playground that didn't have a fence around it, and a child was killed in the 1950s, a Filipino kid, and they put up a fence, and then in the 80s, as you say, it became this garden, part of the slug gardens.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah.
Marga Gomez, you're such an incredible performer and icon, and you've been in San Francisco for many years, and
decades.
I wonder how this walking tour feels to you. First of all, I want to ask you about the performance-driven aspect of it, but I mean, as a longtime San Francisco resident, what does this mean to you?
Thank you for that question. Let's see how I can keep this under an hour, this answer. But yes, I am honored to be part of this project, and I didn't even realize what kind of an effect it would have for me, because I'm kind of a tunnel vision girl, and I don't look around, and it's not even like I look at my phone. I don't know what, you know, but I just don't look. And since I've been working on this project, I've just had this awareness boost, and also a directional boost. Like, I know my right and my left because I have to guide people. Before I met Seth and got into the show, I was going through a depression that I think a lot of us are who've been in San Francisco through the 80s, through the AIDS crisis, through the 90s and the dot-com boom and the displacement and all that, and seeing beloved locations and arts venues disappear, and seeing communities displaced and people of color displaced. And I didn't really know where to put that. So it was just a constant pressure, you know, pressure on your heart. And now since I've been, you know, I found out about this project at a cocktail party. Somebody told me, you know, I was sort of talking about that, and they said, well, you should talk to Eisen Presents, and they're doing this thing. And since I've been doing it, even though we're not at City Hall stopping certain development, we are also bringing back memories and bringing back leaders and visionaries that made San Francisco the kind of place that everyone wants to live in now. So I actually was a performer at one of the locations that we visit. That's the Cat Club, but it used to be the Bay Brick. And in a tour that talks about families and workers, and also talks about the leather community, this is also a moment when we celebrate the lesbian impact in the neighborhood with this place called the Bay Brick, and leaders like Lauren Hewitt and Kathleen Connell, and also the connection that gay men and lesbians had, particularly during the AIDS crisis, in activism to try to get money for research and all. Well, it's all addressed in this tour as we look at buildings and we look at what green spaces are left, and we have an entertainer, a Maria David, embodies the kind of entertainer that played at the Bay Brick. So it is, it's really weird. Like, I'm actually referenced in the piece itself as one of the relics from the 80s, and we'll get Marga Gomez to MC, and then I say if I can give it away as my character. Oh, Margot Gomez, I heard she's great in bed. So it's very meta, and I love all that, and I really am a different person from when this started. And I'm also an expert on all things South of Market now.
That's wonderful. This ticket information is at izen.org, and I just realized that's your last name, but it's EYEZEN.org for Out of Sight. And the last one sold out, didn't they?
Yeah. Our last tour was in North Beach. It was much bigger of an affair. We had 14 characters and 30 histories. This is a little bit smaller. I think our audiences were telling us, like, okay, I know there's a lot of history, but let's limit it. And I think limiting the scale and having a smaller group of performers, so there's six performers in this show, actually has helped us a lot to just sort of focus the histories that we are going to bring to life. And it gives an audience, I think, more of an opportunity to digest the material, because it's still quite a lot.
And what do the performers do on the walking tour?
Well,
we begin with a ritual. We honor the Ohlone people who were there before anyone. We have a wonderful, legendary drag performer, Landa Lakes, who's also an artist. And so we begin with that in the garden. And then we switch off from performance to taking people to the next location, to the next place that either existed or we make it exist, and we tell the stories. So it's a combination of being an actual tour guide, which is very, very fun, and also getting the people, wrangling our audience to the next location, and, you know, with charm and songs and tidbits and a little bit of audience participation. And then we get to another performance, another reenactment. Would that be right, mm-hmm. Seth?
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot of surprises, you know. I mean, you know, we're walking on the street, and then we're talking about things that we pass along the way, as you would in any walking tour. But it's different because the people telling the stories are the characters of the show, or these histories of people who don't exist anymore. Right.
Yeah.
So like, for example, it's the first thing on my head. I'm thinking about one of the two founders of the Folsom Street Fair, Kathleen Connell, who is still living. And then there is Michael Valerio. And so we bring Michael back to life, and Marga plays Kathleen. And it's just really beautiful, both to talk to the spirit, you know, like have them have a voice, give them a voice.
What I love about this scene is, first of all, working with Brian Freeman, who I worked with in the 80s in the San Francisco Mime Troupe. He was my director then, and we're all friends. And so we're actually playing dear friends and partners in crime or activism. And Michael Valerio and Kathleen Connell were housing activists. They, of course, created this very high, high-profile LGBTQIA-LMNOP event, but they started as just lesbian and gay men working for senior housing and activating for small families. But they also, you know, like to have fun. Hmm. So then they came up with the fair that raised money for senior housing and people with AIDS. So it's the intersectionality that's very much a part of this tour.
Yeah, I'm getting all weepy.
Oh, I know.
More information is at izen.org. Is that the best place for people to find out?
Uh-huh.
EYEZEN.org for Out of Sight, SITE. Thank you so much. This is really incredible. And so they're running until when?
Yeah, it's running this weekend. We have two shows on Saturday. There's a 12 o'clock show and a 3 o'clock show, and then one show at 1 p.m. on Sunday. And there are still tickets. You can also see them on Facebook. You can get tickets at iZen Presents on through Facebook.
And this weekend and the following weekend, right?
Yes. Yeah, so it runs from the 8th through the 16th.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're listening to Open Air here on KALW, and in just a minute we'll be hearing from critic at large Peter Robinson.
You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love, but confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. You keep lying when you ought to be truthing, and you keep losing when you ought to not bet.
Hi and hello, I'm Peter Robinson, and my guest today here at KLW 91.7 FM is a fellow author, Joel Strap McCure. He and I worked together, maybe 30 years ago on a book called The Insight Guide to Provence. It was a cultural history, a travel history, and Joel is back with his trilogy now because he has spent 20 years walking around the Mediterranean. These boots on Joel's feet were indeed made for walking. Welcome to KLW, Joel.
Delighted to be here, Peter. Great to see you again. We've aged well. We're alive.
We're alive, we're talking, and I'm doing my best to listen. So let's take each section a piece at a time. And because we covered Monaco, we covered the south of France, I know you were reporting for Time magazine. I know you did several reports for People, especially about the Cannes Film Festival and other parts of the world. And now you're back here in California. And let's see what your memories are about the old days in the south of France and in Monaco, and what has changed today.
Well, I was there 2 weeks ago for the Cannes Film Festival and some other shenanigans. And the one thing that absolutely anybody would remark on is the increase in traffic and congestion from traffic. At the same time, there have been some marvelous infrastructure developments, including the underground railway station in Monaco, which makes it a breeze to go see the royal family and have dinner with Prince Albert and other members of the clan, the Grimaldi clan. There's a new swimming complex in Antibes that's going to be one of the best in the world, where I worked out the other day with the same master's team I swam with in the 80s.
Oh, my God.
It's very odd because I still have a number of friends living there, and for them, of course, the change has been gradual, so they don't really notice the increase in traffic or some of the very positive infrastructural things. But as you can imagine, the Cannes Film Festival was a madhouse. The weather was terrible. I didn't find it that interesting. When I was covering it in the 90s, Princess Diana came. Now we've got Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio.
So your book, of course, is about walking. But just incidentally, I found that train from Cannes to Monaco, in fact, was the best service going, as a matter of fact. You see the coastline and you follow the Mediterranean sitting in a beautiful seat looking out of a railway window.
I'm a great fan of trains, and my daughter lives in Antibes and works in Nice, so I was going back and forth frequently. They're on time, they work, people use them. And in Nice today, there's a new tram. It's probably 10 years old, but it's changed the entire complexion of the city. And what used to be a fairly daunting city is now a very convivial, open, and welcome one due to the tram line and the new city parks and fountains.
Now, your book is about walking. So if we just stay for a second with the south of France and with Monaco, how much space is there to actually walk? There's a lot of private beaches. What was your experience?
Well, the Mediterranean is 16,000 kilometers in distance, and some of that does include the French Riviera, which is one of the more congested and populated parts of the area around the sea. My objective was to walk as close to the sea as possible. The bane of my existence during this walk, at least in countries like France, Spain, and Italy, are private security officials who think they own the entire coast. And you may recall that there's a chateau on the sea between Antibes and Cannes that's owned by a prince from the Emirates, and that area is difficult to get to. But I took on the security officials, and I was constantly right at the edge of the sea.
Now, the book comes in three volumes. So volume one covers, it starts in Algeria. Is that correct?
Well, it basically starts in Antibes, and I walk through France, Spain, and Morocco to the Algerian border. The consulate and embassy in Washington, D.C. would not give me a journalist visa. They wouldn't let me in at the border. It's a highly defended border. When I was there in the early 2000s, the civil war, which began in the 90s when an Islamic elected government was not allowed to take power, was still going on. It's a very dangerous place even today. So when I got to the Algerian border, I went back to Antibes and walked the other direction across the France and Italy to Rome, where my first book ends.
Okay. And do you have a special... I mean, Italy is a very divided country in terms not only of its politics, but its customs, its habits. Do you have a special part of Italy that speaks to you?
Well, I think one of the interesting things that's happened since the European Union was formed and common borders came into effect is that individual localities have each resurged their own independence and their own identity. So you find in Naples and Genoa and other parts of Italy, and in many other countries, that the local dialect, the local customs have actually come back in. These people don't want to be European. They probably never wanted to be Italian. It's a very tribal country and certainly has been historically. As you know, it's impossible for them to have a government. So I was very overjoyed when I walked into Italy. Immediately, you notice the coffee's a lot better. And then you notice these pockets of different societies that are reaffirming their ancient roots. It's a delight to see that.
And from Italy, you went on to what came next?
Well, first of all, to get into Italy, you walk, and this is very rare on the Mediterranean, in three countries in one day. So I walked from Beaulieu in France through Monaco and into Italy in one day. If anybody wants to follow in my footsteps, that's a very interesting place to start because you're experiencing three different countries, three different governments, three different people. After I was in Italy, where I finished my first book, I began the second book where instead of walking every inch of the sea, I have to complete 12 tasks given to me by Athena and Circe. I'm following the footsteps of Homer's Odysseus throughout this whole 20-year hike. And Athena and I and Circe and I, as you can imagine, became very close. So Circe gives me 12 tasks to accomplish. And in the second book, I have to climb Mount Olympus. I have to swim the Hellespont. I have to find Zeus's birthplace in a cave on Crete. I have to find the house where Homer was born. So I'm spending a lot of time on Greek islands in the second book. I had to sleep with Helen of Troy.
Oh, and how did that go?
Well, it was bad. You know, she is on such a guilt trip since she slept with Paris, went to Troy, and started the Trojan War.
Well, I hear she still speaks about you.
She may be speaking about me, but she can't let it go. That whole 1,000 ships and 10-year war has really plagued her.
Now, you speak about swimming the Hellespont. They closed the shipway down for just 6 or 7 hours in one day in a year. Is that correct?
Fewer than that. It's one of the most heavily shipped areas in the world going up towards Istanbul. And they close it for a couple hours for a swim that commemorates a war that the Turks won against the Greeks in the early parts of the 1900s. And about 500 people swim across, coming from all over the world, Australia and everywhere else. And depending on the weather and the conditions of the water, there's a heavy current, so you have to take that into allowance when you make the swim. You either get across or you don't get across. Now, it may sound difficult, but Bo Derek, the 10 actress, swam it a couple of years after I did, which gave me a little bit more humility than I generally have about that task.
And how long did it take for you to swim that distance?
As I recall, it took me about 56 minutes. Now, remember, Lord Byron used to swim across every night. Patrick Lee Fermor, the British travel writer, swam across on his 70th birthday. But it took me about 56 minutes, and I got a medal. I was on the podium. It was fun.
And you're here to tell the tale.
I'm here to tell many tales.
Okay. So after Turkey, you then went on to Greece, or was that part of
Greece? Well, you say after Turkey like it's walking around the block. Turkey is a massive coastline and one of the most difficult in terms of terrain in the entire Mediterranean. It was a battle, and I was scarred and cut and fell and everything else. But once I did accomplish that task, we got to the Syrian border. And I often hike with different people, but I wanted to do Syria by myself. I talked to a lot of Turks who go in there frequently. And at that time, it looked like I could probably sprint down the 180-kilometer coast and make it to Lebanon without getting killed. But my partner, who hiked with me for many years, pointed out that I would either be killed, which didn't bother me too much, or worse, be arrested and embarrassed by all the adverse publicity of being yet another dumb American who crossed the wrong border.
But so in you did in Lebanon, you did run into some security and police activity.
I was arrested in Lebanon, but to get to Lebanon, instead of walking through Syria, I walked around the divided island of Cyprus, which is one of the most interesting places in the Mediterranean. Surreal, out of time. It's been a divided island run by the UN for over 50 years. Turks in the north, Greeks in the south, different currencies, different religions, different everything. Fantastic place to visit.
Now, to cross that line from the Turkish side of Cyprus to the Greek side of Cyprus, you actually have to go through a whole checkpoint series. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a no man's land between the two, and I walked to the border in that no man's land, and then on the other side you will see either the Turk or Greek troops who obviously don't want you to come in. So you have to go to one of the official border crossings back from the sea. Mm-hmm. And I did that going into the north and coming back into the south.
And certainly when I was in Cyprus and writing about it, you know, the British influence was pretty heavy, particularly in the Greek section. Is that still the case today?
Well, the British influence is still there, and they have parts of the island for eternity, or what they think is eternity. They're British army bases. I walked onto one, got arrested there, kicked off. And this, some guy picked me up hitchhiking because I had to get back to where I was staying at the end of the day. And he said, "Are you the crazy American who got arrested walking on that British base?" And I said, "Yes, but in fact, it was they didn't have a well-marked border. They had a little barbed wire fence going into the sea, and it wasn't very difficult to get in. So if these people don't have proper security, what's a guy to do?"
And we haven't covered it, but I know part of your walk was through Spain as well.
Yeah, I walked through the entire length of Spain from the Costa Brava down to Algeciras and went across to Tangiers in Morocco.
And you had a couple of adventures in Spain. Were they with fortune tellers or God knows what?
I met a sorceress in Spain who is still one of my best friends. I've run into a lot of characters. It's not just in the paths and footsteps of Odysseus and Alexander the Great, which is what my third book's about, but I run into real people who wind up hiking with me for a few weeks, spend time, and then either we keep in contact or we don't. But yes, you're right. I was arrested in Lebanon and accused of being a spy for Israelis. I had a very high-tech GPS at that point, and so they took the GPS and the phone, and they took me from the place I was taken in to Beirut, the top of a building of the internal security forces. They finally let me go. They called the embassy. They have to call within 24 hours. They called at hour 22. They let me go, and when I was in Israel talking to a member of the Netanyahu government, I said, "Look, they arrested me. They thought I was broadcasting where Lebanon military sites and activity was." And the guy from the Israeli government said, "You know, if that's how they think we get our information, we'll have no trouble with that war."
Now, I know I'm going to be introducing you tonight at Sausalito Library, and I know you're going to be talking about this walking around the Mediterranean. But what advice would you have for people who want to set out on this type of journey?
Well, I led guided tours for a thing called the Blue Walk on the French Riviera for a number of years. I think you can either go alone and take some risks, or you can go in full comfort and do it 4 stars.
So, Jill, tonight we'll be talking about The Idiot and the Odyssey. And this is at Sausalito Library in the Council Chambers. Again, I want to thank you for being with us here today at KALW. And let's hear more in the footsteps of the god. The god in this case is Joel Strap-McCure.
Thank you, Peter. Delighted to be here.
Thank you so much for listening to Open Air. And thanks to Peter Robinson. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulip. And special thanks to producer Neil Swinkles and board operator Jean Marie. Thanks for listening.